striving to enrich lives by sponsoring thousands of public concerts in the United States. Schedules at musicpf.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from World Gourmet Foods, now at 105 Krispy Kreme Drive in Bloomington, featuring over 1,000 kinds of teas and more. Daily tasting and an extensive Saturday tasting with over 50 items. Information at worldgourmetfoods.com, bringing the taste of the world to Bloomington Normal. Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to join Anthony Brown's Asian American Orchestra on November 6th. Following the performance will be a free afterglow performance in the lobby from the Yang Ying Band. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. 7 minutes past 1 o'clock. In this portion of the program, we were to talk with journalist Peg Tyer about her book, The Trouble with Boys, a surprising report card on our sons, their problems at school, and what parents and educators must do. But we haven't been able to reach her. So what we're going to do is we're going to reach into the archives and rebroadcast another program that dealt with school, and that is a program about school lunches. So as this is a program from the archives, we won't be able to take any calls this afternoon. In the meantime, we will see what happened to Peg Tyer and see if we can get her rescheduled. So here we go. School lunch politics. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Almost 60% of all school children in the United States get free school lunches. In most cities, the program is the single most important source of nutrition for poor children. 80% of Chicago school children are eligible for free lunches. I found those figures in a new book by historian Susan Levine. The title, School Lunch Politics, The Surprising History of America's Favorite Welfare Program. Susan Levine is our guest this afternoon. Levine argues that school lunch politics, in her words, encompass a combination of ideals and frustrations, reflecting at base America's deep ambivalence about social and racial equality. She says that lunch programs have historically only covered a portion of the cost of meals for children. They were not always free. In most states, children paid a fee for lunch. It wasn't until the 1970s that the children most in need were provided with free meals at school. In this portion of the program, we'll take a look at the history of school lunches and ask what that history reveals about us. Listeners, as we talk, please feel welcome to join us with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Susan Levine, is a professor of history at the University of Chicago. In addition to School Lunch Politics, she's the author of Labor's True Woman and Degrees of Equality. Her new book is part of the series Politics and Society in 20th Century America, and it is published by the Princeton University Press. Again, those phone numbers, if you'd like to join us with a question and comment, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Susan Levine, good to talk with you. How are you?
Thanks.
Very nice to be with you this afternoon. So here at the outset, can you give us a little bit of an overview with this question, answering this question, how well are school lunch programs serving American kids today?
Well, it's a good question. And I think that the answer has to go in two directions. First, most people think when you ask that question, how well is the school lunch serving children, they think about the food. And, of course, that is a big consideration for many people and the quality of the nutrition that's actually being served. But the other question is just exactly how many kids are being served, how is the program funded, and where does school lunch and child nutrition fit into American policy considerations? So there are two ways of looking at that question. And I think the answers are, in both cases, not as well as they could. The children are not being served as well as they could be.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things about this is it's a federal program, but it varies so widely state to state, local district to local district.
Right. And that's why I call it a welfare program, because in that way, it takes more of the pattern of American social welfare programs, which are federally funded to a certain degree, but they're run locally. Each state runs its own welfare program, and each state runs its own school lunch program. And that's why it varies so much from state to state and community to community.
Yeah. Well, here in this part of the country, can you give us some idea of what's going on and, you know, the food, how many kids are being served? I mentioned in the introduction that 80% of Chicago school children are eligible for free lunches.
Right. Well, there are two different considerations. One is the free lunch, but then, of course, the school lunch program isn't only free lunches. So you have to look both at the number of free lunches served, and that is also how many kids qualify for free lunch, but then how many kids buy their lunch every day at school, and it's a different number. But they're very closely related because oftentimes, I think in most cases, the kids who pay for their lunch are in lots of ways subsidizing the free lunches. So the figure 80% of Chicago public school children qualify for free school lunches means that most kids in the district, I don't know the exact number, but most kids in the Chicago public schools buy their lunch at school and in some way participate in the program, but 80% get free lunches, and they get free breakfast as well.
Mm. And how well are the kids being served in Chicago in terms of, you know, some healthy food on their plate?
There's a new initiative in the Illinois legislature, which the exact name escapes me right now, but it combines nutrition with agricultural policies, and it's trying to put healthy meals into schools. There's also a federal mandate now that talks about healthy food. But as I said, there are two different ways of looking at it. So the quality of the lunch is probably better than most people think. In other words, most people assume school lunches are pretty unhealthy. But actually, there's some pretty stringent federal standards in terms of the nutritional content of the lunches. Now, whether children eat all of the lunch to get all of those nutrition is another story. But there are guidelines and there are standards. They could be improved, but they're there. So children, I would say, in that sense, especially poor children, are getting important nutrition every day at school. Now, whether children are being served in terms of the kinds of support that exist for the program in terms of public policy, that's another question. And I think that there's probably less thought given to that than to the nutrition.
Hmm. Well, talk with us about that second question.
I think it comes down to a matter of funding. The federal subsidies for school lunches don't cover the whole cost of the lunch. And so the local district, the state and the local district have to subsidize the lunch in addition to the federal contribution. In most cases, public funding, whether federal, state, or local, doesn't cover the cost of lunch. And so schools sell lunches or sell a la carte items in order to make up for those costs. And that's where the problem comes in, because as soon as, of course, you raise the price of lunches, some kids will stop buying the lunch, and there's less subsidy for the free lunch. And the subsidies are rather unequal in the sense that the richer school districts can afford more subsidies than the poorer school districts. So that's where the inequalities come in. And I think it's largely a matter of the public understanding and thinking about what is the public responsibility to child nutrition.
Mm. And today, as we are seeing rising prices for food commodities, lunch prices have to be going up.
Exactly. And if you look, I get an alert every day on school lunches, and the posts now are either talk about the price of food going up, which is really a problem for school districts and lunchrooms, and the number of poor children qualifying is going up as well. And so there are two issues facing the school lunch program that are going to be, I think, real, problems in the coming months.
Mm. And do you think we'll address those problems?
I think probably not as well as we should. School districts are going to be in a pinch because as their costs go up, they have to find ways to subsidize the meals. The federal subsidies won't go up. I think that the school lunch program is up for reauthorization, I think, next year. So the subsidies probably won't go up until then, the federal subsidy. So where are the districts going to get that extra money? That's the question.
Mm. Well, let's talk about how we got here, how we got to this system where families are essentially subsidizing the lunch program. What led to the creation of the National School Lunch Program in 1946?
Good question. Up until 1946, there was a kind of hodgepodge of school lunch programs run mostly locally, often volunteers ran them, usually mothers in the schools, PTAs. And in the 1930s, with the Great Depression, a lot of teachers and school districts became concerned about the growing number of hungry children in the schools. The programs in the 30s were largely focused on nutrition education and feeding poor children. In the 1930s, the number of hungry children began to increase at the very same time that American agriculture faced a real crisis with prices plummeting. And so the federal government, the Department of Agriculture, began to buy up surplus commodities in order to keep the prices up. And they decided one of the best things they could do with those commodities would be to distribute it to school lunch programs. And so the program really started as much as an agricultural subsidy as it did a child nutrition program. And that's really one of its central tensions to this day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The legislation that created the program was championed by a senator from Georgia, Richard Russell. Tell us about him and what motivated him.
This is a very interesting story. Most people think that the school lunch program was part of the kind of New Deal, Roosevelt social welfare initiative. But actually, it was more complicated than that. And as you say, Richard Russell, who was a Democratic senator from Georgia, was one of the so-called fathers of the National School Lunch Program. Russell was a staunch segregationist. He did not believe in racial equality, but he also had an understanding of agriculture and a sympathy for farmers in his state, in a certain way, black or white. And he latched onto the school lunch program as part of a way to support farmers in terms of keeping up the prices of farm commodities. And at the same time, the idea of helping children was a good one. And so he really was an important figure in shepherding the program through Congress.
Who else championed the bill? I mean, this is one of the interesting things about all this history is that there are plenty of strange bedfellows.
Right. Well, another was Allen Ellender, who was a Louisiana senator, also a Southern Democrat, and not much more liberal than Richard Russell. And then these Southern agricultural supporters managed to craft an alliance with some Northern liberals, most particularly some of the New Deal legislators, but also Jerry Voorhees, who was a very liberal senator from congressman from California. So they did indeed have an odd coming together, but I think it was because the idea of feeding children, especially feeding poor children, crossed a lot of boundaries and enabled these guys to work together. Then they crafted the program, which had its own limitations, but it also was a very idealistic program.
Yeah. What were the compromises that were made in order to get this thing up and, you know, approved by the Congress?
Right. Well, I think the most significant compromise was the extent to which the program was put into local hands. And this was specifically because the Southern representatives did not want the federal government to dictate the rules, and they wanted to be able to maintain segregated schools, and they didn't want to have to deal with that issue, and they didn't want any interference. And so by leaving it, if the federal government, say, had taken control of the program, they would have mandated some kind of equality in the system. In other words, equal resources to all schools. But leaving it in local hands meant that they could go with what they called local custom, which was a code word for segregation, in which they could craft different kinds of funding schemes, different kinds of distribution schemes. And so the fact was, in the South, until I would say probably the early 1970s, there was a good deal of inequality in the school lunch program. Black schools had very few resources for school lunches. Most of them didn't participate. Poor districts had a lot fewer resources than the more wealthy districts.
Hmm. What was the price for lunch?
When and where?
Yeah.
This is one of the issues, is that there's the answer to that question is very local. I mean, down to the particular school sometimes. So that it's very hard to answer that question in a general way.
Yeah.
And that's still the case. The price varies by district and by school.
Is the price lower in places where the population is the least able to afford lunch?
Traditionally, it has been lower, yes. And that is both good and bad. It's good for the students who are buying lunch. It puts an extra burden on the system to come up with enough to pay for the lunches, aside from the federal subsidies.
Mm. Was this a popular program at its inception?
This was a very popular program. When you look at the correspondence from legislators who were working on the school lunch bill in 1946, you get comments like, "I've never seen so many letters about a program. This is, my mailbox is full." I think that, of course, the idea of the school lunch program is extremely appealing. You know, we'll feed kids and we'll do it with our agricultural surplus, and we're, going into the post-World War II period when, the United States wants to be a beacon of democracy and prosperity. So it's a very popular program, I think very misunderstood, but very popular.
Mm. How would you judge its popularity today?
That's a really good question, and I think it goes back. You can maybe look a little bit in the past back to the Reagan era when the Reagan administration tried to cut back on federal programs, and one of the things that the Department of Agriculture did then was to begin to change the nutrition standards, and one of the famous episodes, of course, was declaring that ketchup would be considered a vegetable serving. And at that point, there was a huge outcry in the public and in the press, which indicated to me that it's a very popular program. People, again, now, if you start to say, let's cut out the school lunch program, I think you'd get a hue and cry. But again, I think it's popular but misunderstood.
Well, back early in the program, through the first 25, 30 years, when this program was not serving African American children, was not serving some of the neediest kids because they had to pay for lunch, they were subsidizing the program. Was there any, did anybody stand up and say, wait a minute, this isn't, we're not there?
Well, they did. Some of the reformers were some of the originators of school lunch programs early in the 20th century, home economists and even teachers who had run the program. And they knew that their children weren't being served. The real hue and cry came at the end of the 1960s. As part of the civil rights movement, when civil rights and anti-poverty activists began to target government benefits and government programs and began to expose the extent to which African-American children especially were not being served. I would say that before then, when the program in the 1950s, say, there was not really a popular attention paid to the program, and people in certain districts, I think teachers would identify poor kids who weren't being served and give them, you know, a free lunch. But there was no real movement until, I'd say, the 1960s.
Historian Susan Levine is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author most recently of School Lunch Politics, The Surprising History of America's Favorite Welfare Program. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-WILL. And we have a toll-free number as well, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's take a call now, a listener in Urbana, on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I wanted to ask if you would comment on how much effect the school lunch program has had on the fact that we have so many overweight children. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. There's a very contemporary concern about the school program.
Right. Well, I think that's a really interesting question. When the school lunch program started, or even going back to the early 20th century before it was a federal program, when there were different school lunch programs, nutrition theory or nutritionists believed that poor children needed extra calories because the idea of poor children was they were poor, they were thin, you know, sunken-eyed, not getting enough food. And so when the federal government, the Department of Agriculture, set the nutrition standards for the school lunch program in 1946, they still operated under the notion that poor children weren't getting enough to eat, and they needed calories. And so the early standards mandated butter on the bread, whole milk, puddings with cream, anything to get the calories up for the children. And indeed, until I think early in the 1990s, whole milk was mandated as part of the nutrition requirement. In the 1960s and early 70s, doctors began and nutritionists began to warn about other concerns besides just simply number of calories, and they began to be aware of the problems with high-fat diets and so forth, and salt and so on. And then those concerns only slowly got translated into school nutrition standards. Now, I think the nutrition standards limit the amount of calories from fat. They limit the amounts of sodium and so on. But I think nutritionists still think that the standards could be better. I think you could blame school lunches for obesity, but I think it's probably a little bit more complicated than that and has to do with overall diets of Americans, what kinds of foods are available in different neighborhoods, what sorts of additives and ingredients are in our foods these days. I know that the author Michael Pollan argues that high fructose corn syrup, which is a very new kind of ingredient, has contributed a lot to obesity. So I don't think you can blame it all on the school lunch.
Yeah. It would be interesting as well to look into the history, the political history, the history of America's physical education programs.
Yes, indeed. That's true, which is, of course, one of the things that gets cut often from school budgets. As well, and the other is that if most schools in the beginning of the school lunch period made the food in a cafeteria in a kitchen on site, now I'd say probably most schools or few schools have an actual kitchen. They get food delivered from huge food service corporations, and they reheat it, and they don't cook it from scratch, and so they have less control over it. But also, I was going to say that students have less time to eat. The time for lunch has really gone down. In the early days of school lunch programs, before it was a federal program, actually, home economists used to be very concerned about about students' behavior in the lunchroom, and they would set up the tables and try to have them behave and have conversations and have someone be the host or the hostess and have use lunch as an educational moment as well as a time to eat. But I think that's gone by the wayside.
Yeah, we're down from lunch hour to lunch minutes.
Right.
Let's take another call. A listener in Indiana on the toll-free line. Line 4, good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
From one standpoint, I'd like to congratulate the history departments for taking this kind of move to give histories of these sorts of things. When I was in school, this wasn't on the table, although I saw it coming when I was involved with civil rights movements in the 60s, that somebody eventually was going to start writing histories about these, shall we say, more close-at-home situations in history. Secondly, I'd like for you to talk a little bit more about tomato and ketchup. I was involved with that quite a bit, and sometimes people would say, you're not serious. There's no way that they're doing that in the school system. Of course, they were. And you as an organizer, you had trouble trying to make people realize that this actually is going on. I was wondering if there was any other thing like that the Reagan boys were trying to do in the, say, in the school program that really didn't make the press because it got suppressed quickly. And I guess the next thing is, if you could speak to the use of the federal surplus. Of course, it's used to give out certain foodstuffs to the poor. They usually call them, where I'm here in Indiana, they call them food pantries. And a lot of times you see, the United States Department of Agriculture, blah, blah, blah. I wonder if you could speak to that, and if so, whether or not that would be a next thing on your agenda or somebody else's agenda to talk about the politics of that whole program. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Let's see. There are many parts to that question. In terms of other issues besides ketchup, There are often, and there were especially in the Reagan era, efforts to cut back on federal programs and to try to save money. The Department of Agriculture began to re-examine the nutrition mandates at that point. And there were some pretty ridiculous rules that emerged from that era. I mean, the ketchup as a vegetable. From a certain point of view, you could defend it in the sense that, nutritionally speaking, if you look at, you know, what was in the ketchup, you might be able to make the argument that you could consider it as a vegetable. But it was part of a cut, and so it was, a stretch in that sense. There were also rules that, in terms of the amount of protein, and so that, for example, makers of candy bars argued that because their candy bars have nuts in them, they meet the protein requirement of the school lunch program. Those kinds of arguments are still being made. When Taco Bell or other fast food companies come into school lunch programs, they have to modify their products so that the pizza that you get in the Taco Bell lunch is not the same pizza that you get on the corner. It has to have fortified, the crust has to be fortified, there has to be a certain amount of cheese in it. So there are different kinds of ways of that the food companies get around these issues. And the Department of Agriculture owes a lot to a lot of different interests. Nutrition isn't its only interest. It also has to juggle the food industry, and the food industry wants, each part of the food industry wants its products to be used in school lunches. The suggestion of some nutritionists that we eat less meat isn't met favorably by, the meat industry. So let's see, that was one part of your question.
And then the surplus issue.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is a very interesting problem. When the school lunch program began, there was an enormous, what they called surplus in American agriculture. That is, well, you could call it a surplus. So much being produced that the prices were going down. And the solution, there are many kinds of solutions one could have thought of, but the solution that the Department of Agriculture came up with was that they would buy up this surplus in order to keep the price up. In the 1960s and early 70s, interestingly enough, the surplus began to decline. And so now, in the current moment, there's actually less surplus than there used to be. And that means there's less free food going to schools than there used to be. When that means that schools have to then buy more food on the market or from the food service companies. That could change, if there's a large amount of surplus in some area, that could begin to change. I just saw today an article saying that some large percent of the surplus wheat that we've got this year is going to Iran. So, it's being sold elsewhere.
Hmm. Let's take another call now, a listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, thanks.
Sure.
I think one big special interest you missed there was the soda pop industry.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if Reagan was president when this occurred or whether it was Bush, but I remember in Illinois a big fight. They told us that by letting Coke and everybody into the schools to set up their machines, that this would somehow fix the school budgets.
Yeah.
And I think there's still pop machines at a whole bunch of the schools. And I know in our school district down in Columbia, milk is actually more expensive per ounce than soda pop is. Milk is 75 cents for a small carton, and you can get pop cheaper than that. Well, you know, give kids a choice, they're going to buy the pop every time, and no doubt it has something to do with how fat they all are. I mean, when I was in school, you know, there was no way there were going to be pop machines or candy machines in those schools. If you were thirsty, you drank milk, you know, and I remember it was a big day when they finally got chocolate milk, but, but you know, it's all part of Reaganomics. You know, let industry in, and they're going to do whatever they can to make money. They don't care if the kids get sick or fat or obese.
Well, it's interesting, too. When school lunches began, the home economists who ran the school lunch programs were very concerned about not bringing commercial interests into the schools. And the initial legislation in 1946 banned private companies from running the school lunch program. And it's only since, I would say, the 1980s, late 1970s, early 1980s, that private companies, Congress began to change the legislation and private companies began to be able to come in to schools. Now, the issue of soda machines is a little bit different. For a long time, and I think even now, soda pop isn't part of the school lunch program. Soda isn't subsidized in that way. But then the question is, why did schools bring those machines in? And that's related to the school lunch program. They brought the machines in because they weren't getting enough public subsidies to run the programs that they wanted. So soda machines began to subsidize science equipment, sports equipment, team, you know, paraphernalia, so on and so on. And I think with a growing kind of consciousness of, you know, nutrition in the last 5 or 10 years, a lot of districts have begun to ban soda machines or to limit the hours when they can be open. I still think that in most districts, soda machines can't have to be a certain distance from the lunchroom. They will compete if students have money. And then it's also a question, you know, an issue of equity because, you know, some students can afford to buy sodas from the machine and others can't. So the soda machine question raises a lot of different issues, I think.
Mm. And I want to thank the listener for his call this afternoon. And this gets us, he is taking us into a direction now where, on the one hand, agricultural interests in the food industry have, as you point out, enabled the existence and expansion of meal programs. But, you know, the trade-off is, you know, what kind of trade-off are we getting here? Mm-hmm. You know, do we have healthy meals for kids that allow for them to grow and develop and prosper and do their schoolwork and so on and so forth.
Right. Well, that's why I think that the issue of school lunch is really a political issue, not so much an issue specifically of kids choosing to eat one thing or another. I think it's a matter of politics and of the public making choices. So up till now, the public, in a certain sense, you could say, has chosen to let the school lunch program be skewed towards agricultural interests. In other words, there hasn't been a lot of pressure put on the school lunch program, except for periodically, to counter those interests and to shape a program that would be nutritious, that would be more, would include more nutrition education and so on. Mm. Now, the Department of Agriculture has a whole section devoted to school lunches, and they do a lot of nutrition education, but a lot of their materials do come from food industries, and some nutritionists feel that skews the message. You know, but these are political choices, and they're legislative choices, and I think that's something that deserves more public attention than it's gotten.
Yeah, one can see historically how the USDA is the agency that is responsible, but has there ever been any thought given to putting the school lunch program into the hands of another agency.
Absolutely. In the 1940s, as Congress was debating the school lunch program, there was a question about where it should go, and some proponents wanted it to go in under the Commissioner of Education. There wasn't at that time a Department of Education. This decision to put it in the Department of Education was a complicated maneuvering, which in part hinged on the interests of the Southern segregationists who wanted to keep control of the program, and they didn't want education officers from the federal government to go into their states. They were more comfortable putting the program in agriculture. At the same time, the representatives from the agricultural bloc, Southern, Western, and Midwestern, were a strong voice in Congress, and so they too wanted to keep the program in education. So there was a debate at the beginning about whether the school lunch program should be an educational program and a nutrition program, or it should be an agricultural program, and agriculture won out. And then there were, along the way, debates at different points, in the 1960s, when there was a new Department of Health, Education, and Welfare that began to look to issues of equity in education. Again, there was a suggestion under Califano that the school lunch program be taken away from education and placed in health, education, and welfare. Again, the agricultural interests were quite strong, and that didn't work.
Yeah. So how, I guess that answers the question I was going to ask next, I suppose. How entrenched is the way things are done? What would it take to take a fresh look and to do what needs to be done?
I think that's very difficult, and I would not advocate taking it out of agriculture. I think that it is very entrenched, but I think that there are a lot of well-meaning nutritionists and school administrators and, you know, activist parents and so forth across the country who could push for reforms and who could push for making the program both nutritionally more sound but also fiscally more sound by, bringing to the public attention the kind of issues in the funding of the program and the lacks that exist. So I wouldn't myself, you know, I think that ultimately I would like to see a universal lunch program, free lunch program for all students. I think that's also probably pie in the sky, and I think a lot of the nutrition reformers advocated for that along the way, but understood that that was sort of utopian. Short of that, you know, I think that there are ways in which the Department of Agriculture and local schools can be supported in pushing for more equitable arrangements.
How do other nations deal with this issue?
Very interesting question. In Britain, for example, and in most of Europe, actually, school lunches are, there's universal school lunch, and children don't really have to pay for them. School lunches in those countries were not tied to agriculture. They were always tied to social welfare programs and the welfare state. And so that tension that exists here was a little bit different in those countries. And another interesting note is that after World War II, countries like Japan, which were occupied by the United States, began to run school lunch programs on a kind of welfare model as well, and they have a thriving school lunch program going. An interesting note in terms of the Japanese lunch program is that the Americans, after World War II, when they began to establish those programs, wanted to establish American diets for the Japanese. And, of course, the Japanese like to eat rice and Americans like to eat bread, and that was a tension. But anyway, in Europe particularly, the school lunches are run on a pretty different model.
Yeah, that's an interesting part of this story that we really haven't touched on too much, is the issue of culture.
Right, right. Well, there's nothing more profound in a culture than its ideas about food. And early on in the 20th century, the people who were running school lunch programs, not they weren't federal programs, but these are local volunteer programs, were nutritionists, home economists, and largely women who were involved in social reform movements in the progressive era and in the early 20th century. And one of their goals in establishing lunch programs in schools was basically to Americanize immigrants. This was a period in which large numbers of immigrants were coming to the United States from Southern and Eastern Europe. They were speaking different languages. They had different cultures, and they ate different kinds of foods. And so the early nutritionists would believed that their notion, their ideas about diet, which they felt were based on science and scientific research, that these were the healthiest diets. And so they, for example, disapproved of Italian women who used olive oil or Eastern European women who made cabbage soup or highly spiced foods. They thought that these were unhealthy for children, and they believed that a sort of bland milk-based diet was the best, most nutritious diet. And so you get a lot of literature about what to feed children, what kind of food you should eat. And interestingly enough, when the school lunch program began, it was coming out of a period in World War II when there was a lot of attention to the culture of food and to feeding people in large groups, not just the army, but in terms of factories and civil defense plans, et cetera. And one of the most famous anthropologists in the United States, Margaret Mead, was head of a food and nutrition study committee out of the federal government, and they recommended a very bland diet. And so that's sort of the how school lunch menus began to be developed.
We sure made a U-turn there, didn't we? Well, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Susan Levine, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me.
Susan Levine is a professor of history at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She is the author, most recently, of School Lunch Politics, The Surprising History of America's Favorite Welfare Program. The book is published by the Princeton University Press. And that was an interview from the archives. We've rescheduled the interview that we had scheduled for today with journalist Peg Tyrer about boys and school. She will join us on November 18th in the 1 o'clock hour. Let's find out what happened today in Kansas City and in Chicago. Here with settlement prices this afternoon, Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was the kind of day where rising tides lifted all boats. A broad-based surge in commodity prices across the board spilled over into the grain pits in Kansas City and Chicago, and a huge rally ensued. Let's look at the particulars. In Kansas City, December wheat, a high on the day of 613 and a quarter, a low of 557 and a quarter, settling 598, up 44 and three quarters. December wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, a high of 574, a low of 521, settling 561 and a quarter, up 47 and a quarter. March, a high of 594, a low of 539, settling 581 and a quarter, up 47 and a quarter. May, a high of 607 and a half, a low of 593 and a half, settling 595, up 47 and a half. July, a high of 620 and a half, a low of 570, settling 608 and a quarter, up 47 and three quarters on the day. December corn, a high of 420 and three quarters, a low of 402, settling 420 and three quarters, up 30 the limit. In fact, the March, May, and July contracts all limit up today. The March, a high of 438 and a quarter, a low of 420, settling 438 and a quarter, of course, on the limit. The May, the high 450, the low 433 and a half, and settling at the 450. And the July, 460 and three quarters for the high, the low 442, and, of course, the settlement at 460 and three quarters. Take it out to September, a high of 470 and three quarters, a low of 456 and a quarter, settling 469 and a half, up 28 and three quarters. December of 2009, a high of 481, a low of 464, settling 480 and a quarter, up 29 and a quarter on the day. November soybeans, a high of 948 and three quarters, a low of 912, settling 937 and a quarter, up 58 and a half. January, a high of 958, a low of 921, settling 947, up 59. March, a high of 969 and three quarters, a low of 935, settling 959 and a quarter, up 59 and a half. May, a high of 979 and three quarters, a low of 946, settling 969 and a half, up 59 and three quarters. July soybeans, a high of 988 and a half, a low of 953, settling 977 and a half, up 59. Take it out to November of 2009. A high of 985, a low of 948, settling 970 and a half, up 55 and one half on the day. December soybean meal, a high of 286.80, a low of 273, settling 283, up $16.20. January, a high of 288.70, a low of 276, settling 285.30, up $16.60. December soybean oil, a high of 34.38, a low of 33.40, settling 34.33, up 245. And January, a high of 34.87, a low of 34.15, settling 34.87, up 250 on the day. A quick look at outside markets for you. December crude oil trading at $67.25. It's up $4.52. November ethanol settling at $183.08, up 11 6/10 cent. The U.S. dollar at $85.01 is down $1.21 today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 9,077, and it's up just over 12 points, while the NASDAQ is trading at 1663, and it's up almost 15 points. We'll have settlement prices in just a moment. From CME Livestock Group, this is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Livestock prices were higher on the day today in Chicago. October live cattle, 91.95 the high, 90 even the low, 91.65 the settlement, that up 190. December, 91.70 the high, 89.55 the low, 91 even the settlement, that up 212 and a half. February, 92.90 the high, 90.85 the low, 92.52 and a half the settlement, that up 220. April, 93.65 the high, 91.40 the low, 93.20 the settlement, that up 230. October feeder cattle, 96.10 the high, 95.75 the low, 95.80 the settlement, that up 25. November, 97.10 the high, 95.95 the low, 96.50 the settlement, that up 107 and a half. January, 96.30 the high, 94.90 the low, 95.90 the settlement, that up 180. March, 96.80 the high, 95.50 the low, 96.50 the settlement, that finishing up 157 and a half. December lean hogs, 58.45 the high, 57.40 the low, 57.57 and a half the settlement, that down 47 and a half. February, 65.35 the high, 63.95 the low, 64.32 and a half the settlement, that down 12 and a half. April, 71.30 the high, 69.85 the low, 70.47 and a half the settlement, that up 27 and a half.